Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hey, hey, welcome to Page Break. I'm your host, Brian McClellan, coming to you as the cold fingers of winter creep down the mountains in Utah. Before we begin, I'll indulge in a quick bit of self-promotion. I have a new Redbubble store. For those that don't know, Redbubble is a service that allows artists to upload their designs for printing on dozens of different media. You can head on over there for matte prints from all my books or to get yourself some fancy Powder Mage swag. Additionally, I'm making just one public appearance this year, and that's at Brandon Sanderson's mini convention in Provo, Utah, on November 22nd and 23rd. I'll be there to chat, and we'll have books to sign and sell. Now on with the show. My guest this week is Kevin Hearn. Kevin is the best-selling author of the urban fantasy Iron Druid series and the epic fantasy Seven Kennings. He also co-writes the Tales of Pell with previous guest Delilah S. Dawson. Kevin and I chat about the mental health benefits of getting out in nature, Kevin's epic fantasy series, the future of Iron Druid, childhood whimsy in our adult lives, travel as inspiration, and so much more. Enjoy my conversation with Kevin Hearn. You moved out of the country a few years back.
Yeah, I did.
You're in Canada now. How have you been enjoying it?
Oh, I love it. Honestly, it's so much more chill.
Yeah.
In every way, I suppose. It does get darn cold in the winter sometimes, and that's when I start to look for, you know, is there a way I can escape to the south? But other than that, I just really like it up here a lot. One of the things that I've come to appreciate is that if you go out to a restaurant, we can do that again. You don't have, like, if you're going to pay with a credit card, they bring a little machine out to you rather than take your card away and disappear and do all kinds of shady stuff with it. So yeah, it comes right to the table. You type in whatever you want for your tip. It's usually just a percentage. You can put in what you want. Boom, you're done, and the card never leaves your sight. And I like that. And that, I also like that the fact that they call it the machine,
yeah,
not a terminal or whatever. It's always, do you need the machine? Yes, I do. Thank you. So there's a lot of little differences like that.
Yeah, that's such a weird little cultural thing. Like, because I noticed that in Europe as well. And I noticed that, like, when I tried to pay with credit cards, everybody had one of those machines, but they were always vaguely annoyed that I asked to pay with a credit card.
Yeah.
But like in the US, it's like everything is with credit card. So it's kind of a strange cultural difference.
Yeah. Well, Canada is very used to it, where you're going to be paying with a card, and they have a ton, you know, multiple machines per business so that they don't have to wait for somebody else to get done with it. And, you know, I just kind of like that little difference. And of course, I like having healthcare that I don't have to write a check to an insurance company for, things like that. It's wonderful. I'm still waiting on becoming a citizen, but I'm a permanent resident now. So.
Oh, wow. Yeah. Do you think, are you going to keep a dual citizenship in the U.S. or do you think you're going to go straight Canadian?
Well, yeah, you would have to renounce your U.S. citizenship, and I don't really have a need to do that. That's fine. So I'll be dual wielding, which is a goal for a lot of people. You want to become a dual wielder of passports. So.
Right.
Yeah.
That's fun. I found it amusing because I was looking through your Instagram again this morning, and I found it funny because it looks very much like where I grew up in Cleveland.
Yeah.
You know, that very lush greenery everywhere, lots of birds and everything. But I know that you're from Arizona. And yes. So it kind of cracks me up seeing you in a locale that's so different than where you probably spent most of your life.
Yeah, I really love that part of it. One of the best things that I've gotten into is nature photography now, because Chuck Wendig was saying, hey, this is a lot of fun. You should try it. And then once I did, I was like, oh, my God, you're right. You have to put out some cash to get yourself a nice lens, you know, a nice zoom lens, 100 millimeter to 400 millimeter. But I've realized that it is probably the best investment in my mental health I've ever made, because I go out and take these pictures of birds. Then after I'm done walking around in nature, which is itself therapeutic, I get to come home and then start looking through. Did I actually catch anything? You know, because, you know, half the time, you know, the birds move so fast. You just got a picture of some leaves, you know, like if a bird's like, haha, missed me. But then you get some that are just gorgeous and you get to spend time, you know, fixing them up, sharpening them, whatever you do, want in the photo editing software. And that's fun too. So it's a wonderful, relaxing hobby that does no harm to anybody. So I love it.
Oh, that's very fun. You know, we live in Utah now, but Michelle and I spent our first 8 years of our marriage back in Ohio where I grew up. And right. We talk a lot about, you know, we don't miss the weather because, you know, Ohio rains all the time. Yeah. But, you know, we're in the high desert now and we don't miss the weather at all. But we do miss kind of that very easy, lush nature of, like, you know, like a place that was like 5 minutes from where we lived was this beautiful duck pond with these gorgeous, you know, kind of boardwalks, and there's beavers, and there's, and even though you're in a major metropolitan area, it feels like you're in the middle of nowhere. And I miss that, because you don't really, you know, in Utah, you know exactly where you are at all times because of the mountains and there's no trees. So, yeah. You know, and they just, it doesn't have that kind of diversity of wildlife. I do miss that.
I'm loving that up here. If you were going through my Instagram, you probably saw at some point, I don't know actually if I put it there or not, but we can feed chickadees right out of your hand, you know. They come and land on you and you feel like, a, you know, the Disney princess kind of thing. it's wonderful. And the boardwalks we have up here across the marshy areas, we got muskrats and things like that. And it's just, yeah, so lush. And then, back in Arizona, you know, you're going to get cactus, and you know, there's a lushness to the Sonora Desert, don't get me wrong, but I don't miss a lot of that. I miss the mountains in Colorado. We spent 3 years in Colorado and I really do miss the mountains, but Canada's wonderful for me.
Oh, that's great. And I'm glad that you're kind of like being very conscious of the mental health aspect and everything. And there's so much about kind of, I don't know, at least maybe in my awareness, the last few years, I feel like mental health has become much more of a focus for people in general. And I think it's just so good for all of us. And, you know, engaging with nature is one of those things that I think does really well for probably anybody.
Yeah, there's actually quite a bit of science building up behind the idea that getting out in nature is really, really good for our mental health, and we should do it more often. And we don't probably do it enough.
Do you find that that trying to be more conscious of your mental health and do those things that kind of help you with being calm and maybe zen-like, do you find that helps with your creativity?
Yeah, it does, because if I'm really anxious about stuff or worried about something, it kind of destroys a lot of my creativity. I have to figure out a way, especially, I mean, you know, very stressful last few years, obviously, for you know, many reasons, political and, you know, pandemic reasons and all that kind of stuff. And so you have to figure out a way to kind of wall yourself off from that a little bit. One way that I managed to do that was staying a little bit off of social media. I would take breaks for months at a time. And then also another way was going out into nature quite a bit. even when I was on social media, I would limit my interaction in a certain way. So
yeah.
I'm going to share some photos. I'm not going to talk about whatever the boiling topic is of today, where everybody hates somebody who said something silly. I don't want to participate in any of that. I'm just going to, here's a cool bird I found, you know, hope you guys are having a good one.
I think that's great. I try to do something similar myself. I slip up occasionally and kind of, you know, say opinions online, which is always a bad idea. But I try to keep it to, you know, like pictures of things I like and, you know, my pets and the food I'm eating and stuff like that. But dumb self-promotion, things that, you know, generally isn't going to get anybody riled up too much.
Right. I've always been a fan of your grilling and smoking endeavors. And, your pictures of meat. Yes. Those are great.
Yeah, it's fun. It's one of those like things that, you know, I reached a point at which I realized I didn't have that many hobbies. Like I played a lot of video games, but, you know, video games is almost like I played so many video games. It was almost like a lifestyle rather than a hobby, which is not healthy. But yeah, I don't know. I realized, you know, I want to get a smoker and I want to like, you know, I want to try to learn how to make these things in a really good way, you know, not just, you know, get a fancy piece of meat, throw it in the oven and then serve it to the family. I wanted to like figure out, okay, how do I do this in a way that's interesting and, you know, subtle and I can learn to appreciate it a little bit more. And I, you know, it's kind of fun. And it's one of those things. I talked to Bob Salvatore for an episode a couple of weeks ago and, yeah. You know, and he was talking about going vegan. And I have so much respect for people that are able to do that. And I want to kind of pare down on the amount of meat I consume for, you know, both health and ethical reasons. But I love meat so much.
Yeah. Well, and you're good at doing it. And the fact that you can kind of explore and do a deep dive into a thing you love. I mean, that's great. You know, you got to pick something like that and go for it. And so I'm into the photography thing. And then also I was getting into making my own craft cocktails, you know, during the pandemic a little bit, because you couldn't go out and, you know, couldn't go out anymore and have a bartender do it for you. So, you know, if you want to do anything besides, you know, what comes in a can, you got to learn how to do something. So that has been kind of fun because of recently getting into making my own syrups.
Yeah.
And the one that I was really surprised by was a cherry blossom tea syrup.
Oh.
So, yeah, you're making cherry blossom tea and adding a lot of sugar in to make a syrup out of it. And then using that in mixed drinks has been really delightful.
That's really fun. I did last year, I made my own raspberry syrup and canned just a few bottles of it. And it was very tasty. We used it for Italian sodas. It turned out dang good. And honestly, the only reason I don't use it more often is because I'm trying to not have as much sugar in my diet. But gotcha. It's so dang good.
Oh, that does sound great. Are you still keeping bees?
You know what? Last winter, I had two hives and both of them died over the winter. We had kind of a weird winter with lots of ups and downs, temperatures and some really cold temperatures. And they didn't make it through. And I've been so busy this last year that I didn't get around to replacing them. And I mean, I've still got, you know, however, you know, much kind of equipment for all the beekeeping stuff, but I don't know when I'm going to get back to it. You know, maybe in the spring if it strikes me, but it's one of those hobbies that requires very little work except for like all of your attention a couple weekends a year. And I struggle finding that like little bit of time where you're like, okay, my whole weekend is, you know, a honey harvest, or, you know, I'm going to take, you know, 5 hours to get, you know, get in and clean all of the equipment really well, you know, and all that stuff. And I need to get back to it. It's a fun kind of sustainable hobby. But I got very frustrated by my hives both dying, and we'll see if I get back to it.
Oh, I'm sorry to hear about that, but I hope you do get back to it. Cause, that was joyful to see that thing going on, that whole process.
It's great. Yeah, it's fun. It's cool to kind of, you know, learn, you know, what, you know, because kind of as I'm getting a little bit older, kind of learn what I like and what I don't like. And, you know, like getting the bees was kind of a childhood thing for me. It was something I had this guy that went to my church, this old German dude, Dieter, who my mom, you know, kind of would go over and hang out with his wife. And Dieter would take me down to his workshop where he built like remote control cars, you know, the gas powered ones. You know, this is back in the 90s before that was like a little bit more widely available. And he'd custom build things like that. And he kept bees. And I, even as a little kid, I thought that was the coolest thing. And I'd always wanted to do it. And so getting bees was like a, okay, you know, I could afford this now. Maybe I should give it a try. And it is a fun hobby. It's kind of cool to learn how, you know, the, like kind of the environmental system around you works and,
yeah,
and all of that stuff.
That's fantastic. You ever notice I don't know, you mentioned getting older, and of course I have a little bit of experience with that too. And it's interesting though, like as you get older, you realize that you're not as concerned with what is or isn't cool anymore. You just don't care. You know, when you're younger, you are kind of consumed with caring about what's cool. And even if you say you don't care, the people who did that were aggressively not caring. So they really did care. You know what I mean? About what was cool. So, and now as you're older, you're just like, you know what? Everybody's going to like what they like. I'm happy for those people who like that thing that I don't care about. I'm allowed to do my thing and nobody's going to really care either. So there's a little bit more freedom just getting older and not caring about what's cool anymore. And I like that.
Yeah. Yeah, definitely. Oh, yeah, freedom is the best right word. It's like, it's a personal freedom though. Like a very like internal freedom of like, oh, you know, this is like a weight off of my like emotional shoulders. Right.
Yeah, exactly. It was weighing down on you when you were younger and you didn't even realize it. And then one day it's like you shrugged off that heavy jacket or whatever. It's like, ah, this is nice.
Yeah. I'm going to do what makes me happy rather than what I think other people, you know, perceive to be happy, you know?
And it's a large part of it's just noticing when you're happy. Yeah. Like if you're happy about something, you're like, wait, what's going on right now? How can I duplicate this? And then if it was not something that used to make you happy, but now you're noticing it, that it does, you know, sometimes I think that slips by us. We're momentarily happy and then we don't realize, wow, we could have been doing that all along. You know, so I'm starting to notice more. And I think that's part of the mental health thing that, you know, just circling back to that idea, just noticing what does work for you, and avoiding the stuff that doesn't.
Yeah. Yeah, definitely. Very much so.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot. We charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weight loss. That's PlushCare.com/weight loss. PlushCare.com/weight loss.
Hey, Page Break listeners, Brian here, rudely interrupting myself for a bit of a plug. Making a podcast isn't free, and I'm hoping that you enjoy it enough to pitch in a pittance. To do so, head on over to patreon.com/pagebreak, where you can toss as little as $3 a month into the tip jar, $5 a month to get the podcast ad-free and early, and $10 a month to hear your name in the credits and feel a smug sense of superiority. You can also buy my books from your favorite retailer or direct from my website. Thanks to everyone who contributes. Now back to me.
What have you been working on these days with your books?
Oh gosh. Right now I'm working on A Curse of Krakens, which is the third book of my epic fantasy trilogy. And, so that's called The Seven Kennings. It starts with a plague of giants. And, the second book is The Blight of Black Wings. And those are both out now. So I'm trying to get that sucker finished. And, then I've got, after that, I'm going to be working on the third book of the Ink and Sigil series. So that's what I've got on deck for a while. I've also got a novella to write and a short story for an anthology. So I've got some, you know, stuff in the hopper, so to speak. Then also what's happening is next year I have a reissue of the Iron Druid Chronicles coming out. They're going to reissue the whole series in trade paperback with new covers.
I saw that. That's like a 10th anniversary celebration kind of thing, right?
Yeah, the fact that I even get to celebrate a 10th anniversary with a new edition is just blowing me away. So thank you, everybody, for reading. I really appreciate it. But I'm also getting to do with these 10th anniversary editions, I'm getting to do some slight modifications to the text, just like, you know how typos will creep in. And then you're like, all right, we're going to get rid of those. Also, though, we're going to add in bonus material for the print readers that was never there before. We had like bonus short stories and novellas that we were including with ebooks or maybe even selling separately as ebook and audio, but they had never been in print before. So we're now going to include them with the 10th anniversary editions. So each novel will have extra goodies in the back. So I'm excited for that as well as the new covers. They're going to be gorgeous.
Oh, that's very cool.
Yeah.
Very fun.
Oh, I was just going to say, they're going to come out like in all next year. So March, you'll have the first three, and then in June, you'll have the second three, and then the last four will come out in September.
Oh, wow. So it's not going to be staggered or anything. It's just like straight up the entire series.
Yeah, the entire series will be coming out next year in these trade paperbacks with the new covers by Sarah Coleman. And yeah, I'm excited.
Dang, that's really fun. So I know that you're still writing inside the universe, but are you done with the main kind of the main plot line?
Well, the Iron Druid Chronicles is narrated by Atticus, and that one is done, yes. But then the Ink and Sigil series is in the same universe. We have a different narrator, but then Atticus and Oberon still show up. So, it's kind of just continuing the story, but we're now focusing on a different magic system and focusing on some different problems in the universe. So, I'm having a great time with it. I love the new characters. And then whenever I bring in the old ones, it's always fun to play with old friends, you know?
Right. It totally is. It's like it does feel I'm trying to cram in a Powder Mage novella right now. And I was writing it yesterday. It's weird going back to something that, I mean, I've only been away from Powder Mage for 3 years now, I think, is when I last was writing in it actively. It's weird to go back to it and be like, oh man, these are like my old buddies. You know, it's like being like a teenager and dusting off the, you know, the toys that you played with when you were a kid that you find in the attic. You know, you're like, Oh, look at that.
Yeah, exactly. Do you still have any of your old like action figures from when you were a little wee person?
So I still have a couple boxes of Legos. My mom let my nieces and nephews, you know, quote unquote, play with my Legos when I was in college, and half of them disappeared, which, you know, unsurprisingly, but I still have a couple boxes of those. I used to have a massive crate of my G.I. Joes, the ones from the early 90s, late 80s that were the 3.5-inch ones. And I actually made the heartbreaking but probably right decision to give them to my buddy Dan Wells, who's a horror author. And he's got 6 kids.
Yeah.
And I was like, you know what? These are sitting in my garage. I don't have kids. I would love to see someone play with them again. That's like way more important to me than kind of the nostalgia of keeping them on hand. And I definitely went through and picked out about a dozen of the figures that had like kind of emotional sentimentality to me. And I kept those and I gave everything else to Dan.
Oh, that's nice. That's cool. At this point, when I buy an action figure, I'm just basically planning on how to pose it with a book that I'm reading for later for social media, you know? Here's a book and here's also Morpheus sitting in his chair. You know, I just have fun with that kind of stuff. So, that's the purpose of action figures. Most of the time they're just on the shelf collecting dust, but every so often their action will be to pose heroically with the book.
Do you still have any from your own childhood?
I don't anymore. Or if I do, they're in storage that I'm not aware of. Yeah. So in theory, they could be out there. I know that at one point I still had the original Star Wars action figures from Kenner.
From
the 70s. Yeah.
Yeah.
But I don't think I really have them anymore. If I do, that, you know, they're definitely in storage and forgotten at this point. So
my oldest brother, I think, is right at your age. And when I was, I think, about 3 or 4, long before I knew what Star Wars was, I loved playing with his action figures. I now know, looking back, that those were the originals and they were like kind of a big deal. And I have a very distinct memory of getting my hands on one of his stormtroopers, one of his original stormtroopers, and a black permanent marker. And he didn't speak to me for weeks after that.
I mean, I've seen some really clever Instagram accounts where they're doing all of these posed, you know, things with action figures, Star Wars in particular. And they're using food and to simulate explosions and lasers and things like that, like spaghetti, like a bunch of spaghetti coming out of a jar if it's tightly packed. And then, you know, certain what do you call them? Strings of spaghetti are sticking out like they're lasers or something, and your character is dodging through them. I love stuff like that, and so I hope to see some more and follow those kinds of accounts. If I was that creative with that, I'd probably do more with my action figures. But I'm so glad people are finding things to do with them besides just make pew 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 noises, you know.
it is fun to see like that sort of, I don't know, childhood whimsy creep into our adult lives, right?
Yeah. That I love that kind of thing. Right now the figure, I guess, that I actually just adore and kind of pay a lot of attention to is actually like a plushie but with a computer chip in it, makes noise. It's a Loth Cat, from the Star Wars Rebels series. And apparently they're not sold in stores. You have to get them at Disney World or Disneyland. And Deanna Rayborn, who's, like a mystery author, was super kind. And she bought me a Loth Cat and shipped it to me. I'm still geeked out that she did that. And it turns out it's because her husband likes my books. And I'm like, yay.
Yeah, that's always the best shortcut, right?
Right. So I was super happy, and I love the Loth Cat. When you pet it, it starts doing meow, you know, doing various noises.
Yeah.
But then what's cool about it, which startled me, you know, the first couple of times it did it, is that it waits and then it'll meow again because you're not petting it. Right. So I'm like, whoa, it brings your attention back to it just like a real cat will sometimes. So I thought that was a lot of fun.
Now, I forget, do you have pets?
I do. At the moment, we have a cat, and then we have a kitten who is staying with us and recuperating from a sort of a mysterious malaise. But it's a shelter kitty that my kid adopted. And, you know, a lot of shelter animals have, you know, issues of one kind or another. And so we're nursing the kitty back to health, and then we're, you know, going from there. But yeah, unfortunately, during the pandemic, my dog's passed away. We haven't, replaced them. So now we just have the cat at the moment.
Yeah. Yeah. We lost, right before the pandemic, we lost two of our dogs, and, and it's that weird roughness, and we're still, you know, we had three dogs for a little bit and our cat, and we're still, so we just have the one cat and the one dog, and we kind of go back and forth on, oh, do we get another dog? You know, like, where do we want to be here? Like, you know, if we get another dog, that means we can't live in Europe in a few years if we want to. You know, there's like little tiny options we're trying to figure out, but we keep going back and forth on it.
Yeah, I understand. Yeah, it's honestly a reason why we haven't gotten new dogs is because when travel restrictions are a little bit, not necessarily relaxed, but I guess just when it makes a little bit more sense to go traveling, we would like to. And so yeah. Dogs will definitely make that a little bit more difficult. So we're probably not going to get any dogs in the near future. We'd like to do a little bit of traveling, see some places we haven't seen yet.
Yeah, it's definitely... That's definitely on our list. We're hoping next year we'll get back out and travel. In fact, the last, I think, big trip I had, I actually saw you in London like 4 years ago or something like that.
Yeah. Yeah. That was wild. That was a pretty good time. I wish that I could get back to Scotland. And I want to head out to Iceland as well, because I've never been and I would love to.
My best friend, he goes on about Iceland. He said that it was just a fantastically beautiful trip. That's definitely one I'd love to hit.
Yeah, for sure. What, you got someplace else you want to go?
So many. Like I want to do like a castle tour of Germany. You know, I want to go to France and I want to see all the cool stuff I've read about in all these, like, you know, both historical and adventure novels since Ooh. I was a little kid. You know. There's a bunch of places I want to go to. I want to visit Portugal and Spain and Italy. I've mentioned on this podcast a few times that we had a big Italy trip planned with a group of my high school friends. And then the pandemic hit and we were going to have 2 weeks in Italy with a huge group of us. And it had taken so much planning to get everybody's schedules aligned. And then the pandemic, and it screwed everything up.
Oh, man, that's a bummer. I hope you get back there. I spent about 5 days in Rome about 4 or 5 years ago, and it was lovely.
Yeah.
It was great. The pigeons, however, watch out, man. They have refined their hunting techniques. They know who the tourists are and who's not guarding their food well, mm-hmm. and they will come down and forcibly take it. And you'll be sick. And then everybody will laugh at you. Watch out. They're terrors out there.
that's rough. So do you think like travel is almost a necessity for an author?
I wouldn't say it's a necessity. I mean, just because there are so many exceptions to any kind of rule you wish to make in writing, you know what right. I mean? I find that it helps me a lot personally. So speaking only for myself, I find travel to be a necessity. It always stimulates my creativity and I am really jazzed to write when I return from travel.
Yeah.
I feel tremendously stimulated. And part of this is just because of the way your brain works. It is always stimulated by seeing something new. And on a smaller scale, it works to break up whatever writer's block you might be having. Let's just go out and drive around a part of the city I've never been to before, or part of the country, you know, take a new hiking trail or a bike path or something. And then you're going to feel refreshed because your brain has been stimulated to, you know, by seeing and classifying, you know, new stuff. And it jogs loose the old neurons and synapses. And I think it always helps. I find myself more creative after seeing something new.
Yeah. I think that you kind of touched on it. Like there's a spectrum there, like of influence, I suppose, because you'll see something cool, like a castle or something that's inspiring, like very directly. But also you just, I don't know, you see other people and you like, even if you don't talk to them, you see kind of the variety of humanity and you overhear conversations and you get to walk around, kind of get the blood pumping. And I don't know, there's so much about, you know, like getting out and like, I've just even on a very teeny tiny scale, like the last week I've every afternoon just to get me out of my own head, I've been driving to kind of a parking lot nearby and then just sitting in my car and writing on my tablet. And honestly, just sitting there and watching people come in and out of stores and, you know, hearing other people's voices and things like that. It's just, there's something about that makes my brain kind of get out of its like malaise of just sitting in my office all the time.
Oh, absolutely. I got an example for you that was kind of, when I got to visit Poland in that same trip, I got to go to Italy. I hit a few European countries at the same time. While I was in Poland, I noticed a couple of things. They're not really into franchises there. It's really mom and pop, you know, small business kind of things going on there. So every place you go is going to have its own unique personality, which is a lot of fun. The other thing they're into is scarves.
Yeah.
They wear, almost everybody seems to be wearing a scarf, and they wear them fashionably. So I was just at a cafe that was, again, a mom and pop kind of place, and sitting by the window and just watching people go by, and all of these scarves and the way they wore them, some of them were piled really high so that you only saw their eyes above the scarf, you know, kind of thing. And I thought that was a fascinating, you know, cultural idiosyncrasy. And then the place itself that I was in had a grog menu. And I'd never seen that. Like, you know, because in the United States, it's like, grog? Well, that's what pirates drink, matey. And that's why we're going to have our grog. But in Poland, it's much more of a normal thing. So they not only have your basic grog, there's a whole grog menu. And I found this like on my last day in Poland, and I was so disappointed I hadn't found it on my first day in Poland, because I would have tried them all. They bring out a large 24/36 ounce mug of hot tea, only half filled. Mm-hmm. And then they bring out a bunch of stuff to dump into it. You know, the part of that being the rum, and then, you know, various fruits or whatever spices to make your grog. And such a cool experience. You know, it's like, you never have that experience in the United States. And, you know, there are so many experiences like that, unique little things that are waiting for us if we do get to travel. And so, I think being able to travel is, in a lot of ways, the ultimate freedom.
Yeah, I had a similar experience when I went to Hungary. I'm in Budapest, and I go with my translator to grab a drink, and we kind of open up the menu, and I was very surprised that, like, this massive menu had like a couple of beer options, and then an entire page of lambics, which I had. You know, like in the US, there's like, at least, you know, a few years ago, there's like one brand of lambics that you can find in most places and no others. And there's just this huge variety. And I'm like, oh, these are so tasty. Like, they're so good. And that's what they like. I probably proven wrong by somebody, but that seemed to be what they drank, at least in this restaurant. And it was just fun to like see a totally different kind of perspective on, you know, just drinking and what people enjoy, you know, that's outside of our own, you know, experience.
Yeah. Speaking of different perspectives on drinking, I'm going to give a shout out to Mallory O'Meara's book. And I know you had her on a few episodes ago, but
yeah,
Girly Drinks, I've read it. It's so honking good.
Yeah, it's very fun.
Yeah. It, the most entertainingly written history I've ever read, and I wish all histories were written that way, you know. But yeah, for those of you who don't know, Girly Drinks is a look at the role of women in alcohol and drinking culture from ancient times to today, and it is absolutely fascinating. It's on sale now. You should buy it.
Yeah, well, it's fun because like something that I came to very late in life was because I was raised Mormon without alcohol in the house at all. Was that kind of drinking culture isn't just drinking. It's a social thing. And when you're raised without alcohol in the house, you don't really understand that. You kind of look at, you know, people drinking as, oh, that's a thing that they're doing. That's not, you know, it's a bad thing that they're doing. But there's a point at which you realize, oh, this is actually like it's just like food. It's a very social sort of, it's an interactive thing. And yes, it can be unhealthy, just like overeating, but it's very much something that facilitates conversation and community interaction that I really find quite cool.
Yeah, I dig it. I love the fact that, you know, because of the development of cocktails and how incredibly delicious they can be, that is every bit as much of a craft as, you know, a chef doing their thing. So there are new combinations and things being made all the time. And not just in distilling, but in brewing as well. There's a whole bunch of stuff to enjoy. So, it's a great part of gustatory culture. And there you go. I should get a bonus point for using gustatory in a sense.
You definitely should. I'm trying to remember if I had met you previously, but I think it was the very first time we met. I have a very distinct memory of my editor, Davey, kind of directing me to this dark corner of the convention room of the convention hall's restaurant, where you were on a little laptop with a drink the size of your face. Just kind of hunched over, doing a little writing under the stairs, you know, out of the way with this massive drink. And Davey goes, "I want you to meet Kevin. Kevin's the best. You should go meet Kevin." And she comes over, and then I kind of hung out with you the rest of the day. And it was just, I love that memory of you with this, just like, no kidding, like it was like 10 inches across, one of those massive cocktails with the sugar all around the sides.
Yeah. To be fair, we were in Texas, and that's the size of drinks in Texas. I remember that. That was something else. And at the time, I you know, Davey brought not just you, but some other people over to meet me. I think that was part of the fun for her that day. It's like, hey, come over here. I want to show you this guy. And so, yeah, she brought folks over to meet me, and it was really sweet of her. And I got to meet a lot of fun folks that way. That was a great time. So. That was in San Antonio, I think.
Yeah, I believe it was. I think it was WorldCon, actually.
Yeah, yeah. I think that was the first and last one I ever went to, honestly. But it was a great experience because, you know, you do meet so many folks, and then, you know, if you ever get to see him again, it might be at a different Comic-Con or another WorldCon. But yeah, it's a great experience.
Yeah. Now, I was curious about something because you kind of made your bones in the industry doing urban fantasy. Mm-hmm. With, you know, kind of the very straightforward urban fantasy sort of the very quick single point of view, all of that. And then you kind of jumped over with Seven Kennings to massive multi-point of view epic fantasy. And I'm very curious where that switch came from. Was it a very purposeful, I want to do something very different than what I've been working on?
There's a lot going into that, and in fact, actually, that massive multi-point of view kind of, you know, very complicated structural sort of thing was something that I had tried to do and failed to do before I wrote the Iron Druid stuff.
Yeah.
So the bare bones of it had actually gestated earlier, but I did not have the writing chops to actually pull it off at when I was first starting out. So you write a few Iron Druid books, and then if, you know, as you progress in the Iron Druid books, I do start to narrate in different voices within that series. And so you do have multiple points of view in the Iron Druid Chronicles as well. But that was also learning for me, you know, to figure out how do I do this so that then I could make the jump to try this where I had 11 different first-person points of view telling a story that still was a cohesive whole. So structurally, as far as I know, I still don't know if anybody else has done that with epic fantasy, because epic fantasy is usually in third person. Or if it is first person, it's much fewer than 11.
Right, and I was shocked at just how many that you went for. And it was... It seemed so ambitious, kind of, you know, compared to, you know, Iron Druid is just fantastic, but it doesn't have that kind of ambition of breadth, you know? And I just, I to this day, I still kind of think about that occasionally.
Yeah, thank you. It was partially because I wanted to bring the, you know, there was a bard, basically. For those of you who are unfamiliar, there is a bard who is telling the story of this war from all of these different points of view that he has collected. And he's doing this to a sea of refugees outside of a city. And he's doing it to sort of kind of entertain them, but also let them understand, why are you refugees right now? What the heck happened to bring you here to this terrible point in your own personal history? And that kind of epic scope and the idea of somebody telling you a bit of a story, of a much longer story, a little bit each night, that came from Homer's Iliad and Odyssey. I was always fascinated by the idea that he took those books of the Iliad and Odyssey and performed them a book at a time over a campfire, each night to some folks. And I thought, well, is there a way for me to take that ancient experience and make it happen for modern readers? So that was what I was kind of trying to do, is like, how do I take that, take the original sort of epic and update it for a modern time? And so A Plague of Giants is what resulted, and Continue to Blight of Black Wings. And then, yeah, as I said, I'm working on A Curse of Krakens now.
Is it going to be a closed out series or a closed out trilogy? I mean,
yeah, it is going to be closed out. It's this last volume is very complicated because of all of the various threads that I have to sort of tie together here. And then also figure out the other thing that's been happening, of course, is a jump back and forth in time, because there's a present day drama going on at the city where all the refugees are. And, the bard is telling what has happened up to this point. So he jumps back in the past, So what's happening, though, is the bard is basically bringing everybody up to the point where, okay, we're now in the present day.
Yeah.
So when that happens, then there has to be a change again of how the narration occurs, because we're no longer going back and forth. So figuring that out was fun. And so, yeah, I've got it all outlined now, and about 67,000 words as of this moment of the drafting. And so I got a little ways to go. It's going to be a few more months, but progress is being made, and you won't have to wait too much longer, hopefully, before I'm able to give a publication date.
Oh, that's very cool. Do you find that you enjoy the kind of the challenge of that complexity?
Oh, I do. I very, very much do. For me personally, as from a professional standpoint, this series is my baby. It's the thing that I'm always going to be most proud of, because I'm doing something that hasn't been done before structurally. So that's what I am proud of. Now, I am also very proud of the urban fantasy stuff for different reasons, and I enjoy writing them. They're a lot of fun to write. But this one is sort of, the epic fantasy is the one that I've really kind of wanted to always finish from the very beginning of starting to be a writer, And it just took me a very, very long time, decades, to get to the point where I could actually make it work. So took a lot of practice.
Do you kind of, when you're writing, do you kind of look at what you're doing in very self-contained chunks? And what I mean by that is, do you plan your career beyond the series or multiple series that you're working on at the time?
Not really, other than the fact that I just hope I continue to have one. You know what I mean? I hope that people will continue to want to read whatever it is I'm writing. I've been obviously, super fortunate so far to have written some things that people liked, and it allows me to write more. So I hope that I just continue to, to be able to do that. I still get mail on the Iron Druid stuff because people continue to just discover it, even though it's been out for 10 years, there are people for whom it's entirely new. And so they'll write to me and tell me how much they enjoyed it. Like, that makes my day. Thank you so much. So, I hope I continue to write things that, people are entertained by. And, but I don't have a specific plan other than, all right, what's the next story I want to tell, So how about you? I mean, are you planning some things, down the road?
I think that I think that the reason I asked the question in the way I did is because I think that I kind of plan in terms of a chunk of my career, in terms of, okay, this is the series that I'm going to be working on for X amount of time, probably, it's always an estimate, right? And I don't really move on from there until I'm getting close to the end of whatever I'm currently working on. Like, I started planning, my next epic fantasy is Glass Immortals, and that's out next year. But I started planning that probably while working on book 6 of Powder Mage. And so I knew that I was closing out on Powder Mage. I knew that I didn't want to get under contract for another Powder Mage universe item. And so I started kind of planning what other universe do I want to kind of play with? And it was kind of, I'm not sure how I'll approach that in the future, because it was a little distracting, you know, at times to be like, well, I've got this kind of shiny new idea in the back of my head. And people, I think when they read the new series, they're going to see some things that I was testing out in book 6 of Powder Mage that wound up being much bigger part of what goes on in the new universe that I've got. And, you know, a little bit more of kind of, you know, a little bit of the political fantasy intrigue, you know, that kind of stuff. And just me kind of experimenting with where to go with characters and things like that. But yeah, I guess I don't plan it out in terms of, okay, here's my 5-year plan. Because, you know, like a traditional kind of career is, oh, well, I want to be manager in 5 years. I want to, you know, I'm looking forward, you know, I'm going to finish my apprenticeship in 3 years or whatever. You kind of have an idea of scope. But when you're writing, it's so much different, because, you know, for one thing, a book may take you 2-3 years longer than you think it will. And another thing, you know, you just, with that creativity, it's so much more nebulous than okay, if I dot all my I's, cross all my T's for the next 5 years, I'll get a promotion. It's so weird how different kind of what we do is from, I guess, what you would think of as a classic career. But I don't know, I try to keep in some perspective and still think of it as, you know, this is my life, it is my career, but it's so much different. You kind of have to, it's a weird perspective to take on it.
Yeah. Well, I was actually discussing with some folks, fairly recently how, we are really super conditioned as we are growing up to tie our self-worth to having a traditional job. And now that we don't have traditional jobs, there's not a lot of advice on how to do that well and plan it well, other than, you know, some people who, you know, may have had a career for a few decades as a writer, but, you know, the publishing industry is no longer what it was when they began. And so their advice might not work for today's current market. I mean, even in the time that I've been doing this, when I first started, it was like, hey, get a blog, start a blog. And now it's like, what, a blog? You know, nobody cares about blogs now. I mean, there are some who blogs that are just fantastic and continue to work very, very well and are fantastic stuff. But I never really, I still have a blog myself, but I rarely update it, maybe 2-3 times a year. And mostly it's Twitter and Instagram. For a while, I was trying every social media thing to say, well, you know, what's going to work? How am I going to reach people? But now you're not sure, do those move the needle at all? And if they do, how much? It's very difficult to quantify. It just becomes a thing where I'm always here to talk to folks who wish to speak to me, but I can't go out and stay on social media a lot if I want to get anything done. So all of those kinds of things that are now part of the career of a writer is a lot of it is, you know, self-promotion and marketing somehow. How does a person who began in publishing with a career 30 years ago really, you know, talk about that and give advice for career planning when things are mutating so fast right now? There's no way that their marketing expertise anyway is going to be relevant at this point unless they're seriously, you know, excellent at it. Another thing you're supposed to do is have a newsletter, you know, and I've got one of those that I send out every month. But it's wild how for a while newsletters were not the thing, and now they're the thing again. And you just don't know. You have to constantly adapt. So it's difficult to know what to do with a career. I think it's a great, question you brought up there. How do we do this correctly? I have no idea.
Well, and it's, you know, kind of going back to like the measure of worth. You know, it's tough because you, as an author, you start, at least I know it happened to me, you start kind of connecting your self-worth, you know, to your career, but your career is broken. Your career is told through your book sales numbers, right? And that's kind of stupidly stressful because you have to somehow conceptualize that, okay, I spent 1 year, 2 year, 3 years of my life on this particular book. And then how many people are actually going to read it? Because, and you kind of, you hit the Times list fairly early in your career. Did you find that once you hit the Times list, you were stressed out about subsequent books doing just as well?
Yeah. Yeah. You worry that, it was a flash in a pan kind of thing. You'll never hit that again, whatever. So yeah, it whether you hit it once, then you're concerned about, you know, you're stressed about, you know, whether you're going to hit it again. And then if you don't hit it, then you are stressed about whether you ever will. I mean, no matter what, you have a stress about, you know, these really sort of silly lists. What I've tried to do now is, for example, the Seven Kennings thing, you know, where I'm spending far more time writing the books than I do for any of my urban fantasy things. They don't sell as well as my urban fantasies do, although they do very well, and they have, you know, they're a really dedicated fan base that writes to me and keeps asking, when's the next one coming? But it's always a thing where, like, the value is not my sales numbers. This very important series to me does not hold its value on how many folks are reading it. I'm glad that I have a dedicated fan base for it, and they want to find out how the story ends, because I do too, and that's wonderful. But you can't really, if you do attach your self-worth to the sales numbers, then you're probably asking for some pretty rough sailing.
Yeah.
And emotionally, you know,
because even the biggest authors can have their ups and downs. It's a roller coaster. And, you know, maybe to somebody like us, you know, like, oh, selling 1 million or 2 million, you know, copies seems like there's no difference, you know, for maybe like the biggest of authors. But I'm sure that a big author that sells 2 million and then the next book sells 1 million, that's half. I'm sure that they just freak out inside.
Yeah.
It's interesting. You got to kind of try to keep perspective on these things.
Yeah, that would be an interesting, you know, having to have, you know, gosh, I wish my only half of my previous book is still a million. I mean, that, wow, that's yeah, a lot. So I'm hoping that, I do try to keep a perspective on everything. And I'm very grateful for people who help me reestablish that perspective, because they'll say, hey, this particular part of this particular book was really helpful to me. I've had, you know, fan mail from folks saying, you know, I got to read this with my dad while, you know, he was recuperating in the hospital or something like that. Just really helped us and helped us get closer or something like that. I'm like, wow, that's so much cooler than thinking about whether I sold X number of copies 1 week, you know. So you really can't tie your self-worth to things like that, even though, unfortunately, the bottom line is what, you know, fuels a lot of decision-making. In the
right, episode. Right. Now, you before becoming an author, you were an English teacher for high schools.
Yeah.
What, do you miss that? Do you miss, like, kind of the job and going and, you know, teaching kids and things like that?
I do miss teaching. I don't miss taking attendance. And I don't miss faculty meetings. you know, those were always a waste of my time, but, I miss the kids, and, I love that the job was different every day, which is also the same for now. You know, every day I'm doing something new with my writing, but, you know, every day, even if you're teaching the same stuff from year to year, like, hey, I'm going to teach, you know, Romeo and Juliet again. It doesn't matter that even if you're teaching the same thing, the kids are going to react differently, and they're going to say something to crack you up, or, you know, it's just, or you're going to see the light go on, and that's going to be wonderful, you know, to see somebody kind of get it and connect with it. I used to love teaching The Wasteland by T.S. Eliot, because I would take them through it line by line and explain the allusions and metaphors and things that are kind of buried in there. And they never really understood how deep poetry could be and how much meaning could be packed into something like that. And when they finally sort of get it, they have a whole new appreciation for poetry after that. And I'm like, my job is done. You know,
did you feel like you kind of stood up there and were able to kind of, you know, looking out at a classroom of students? Did you feel like you were able to watch kind of the light go on in their eyes when they figured something out?
Yeah, but at least for some things like that, they really liked that stuff. And of course, they loved the mythology and things like that, too. And, you know, that was always a lot of fun. And once in a while, you would get somebody who would actually really enjoy their Shakespeare. And so that was always fun when you found the kid who was really into the language like that. So I do miss that part of it. And I know it's got to be super, super hard to be a teacher right now. Not being all the pandemic has made things infinitely worse. And in a lot of cases, I don't see that governments are trying to make things easier for teachers. And so my heart goes out to all the teachers and all the kids, you know, all the parents of kids in school right now who are having a tough time worrying about whether sending their kid to school is going to result in them getting ill. And it's super rough out there at this point. My kid is in college, but doing a lot of it online. And so luckily they've been, you know, really safe. But I know that it's not been easy for everybody. And hopefully the vaccine stuff's going to get approved soon and kids will be safer.
Fingers crossed. Yeah, it's a big... Gosh, one of my good friends is a high school teacher now, and we talk most days, you know, just chatting online. We've got a kind of a group chat for a bunch of us old high school buddies, and talking to him about just the ways things have changed in, gosh, I don't know what, the 17 years since I was a high schooler. It feels like such a short amount of time, but like, you know, everything seems to have changed in that time. You know, smartphones now and social media now and it just, do you feel like maybe you dodged a bullet with missing out on the social media and smartphone stuff?
Yeah, I mean, even when I was still teaching, there was quite a bit of, hey, I'm always texting somebody, you know, there was, what to do with cell phones was always a problem. Probably the biggest behavioral problem that you had to deal with was, like, you know, some kid doing something with a phone instead of, you know, paying attention to whatever they're supposed to be doing at that moment. And there was never a really, you know, the administration kept changing its mind on what would be, you know, the best policy to follow. So, yeah, I'm glad I don't have to deal with some of that stuff anymore. But I do think that we should be paying attention quite a bit to the education stuff, because it's obviously the lack of attention to it for many, many years has resulted in the current state of affairs in the United States, where you have a lot of people unable to discern what a fact is.
Yeah, and that's real rough. I've always been, I don't know, like growing up, my dad was, when I was a really little kid, he was on the school board still, and they talked a lot about kind of like, you know, locally trying to deal with, you know, what parents want versus what the government wants versus what the teachers want to do, and trying to get funding for everything. You know, I don't have children, but I will always vote for a levy for the school, because I, you know, someday those people are going to be my doctors. They're going to be the people that, you know, run my old person's home. You know, I want them to be educated. I want them to know what life is like. And I don't know. It always blows my mind when education isn't really like very important to people, and sometimes it grosses me out, but
yeah, I'm hoping that we're going to continue to see some improvements in that regard. Up here, they do things much differently, and I'm still kind of getting used to it. But I will tell you this, one of the lovely things about Canada is that college is a third of the cost of the United States. So when we were living in Colorado, we were looking into what tuition would be for the University of Colorado at Boulder. And at that time, and remember this was, you know, about 4 years ago, It was $24,000 a year for tuition. So right now we are paying $7,000 a year in tuition. So it's a third of, you know, less than a third of the cost.
That difference.
And that's, by the way, that's Canadian dollars. So in US dollars, that's even less. So basically, my kid is going to be able to graduate college without a mountain of crushing debt. And that is a huge advantage right there that they're going to have going forward. And I wish the United States would figure out what to do about college debt down there, because I think it's holding back the entire economy. But that's one of just many things that Canada's kind of doing, besides the healthcare keeping people secure, and then having college be, you know, a reasonable amount. You know, those are some really concrete things that they're doing to make life a little bit better for folks up here. And so I look at that and then look at the mess, you know, in the United States and go, you know, here's evidence that there are better ways to do things. And a lot of people are just unaware.
The financial aspect, that's crushing for younger generations, especially, you know, like Michelle and I have a chronic physical illness. Michelle has a chronic mental illness, and our just, you know, in a pretty good insurance plan, plus the extra on top cost to us, it's $25,000 to $30,000 a year for the two of us. And that is, If we were both making minimum wage, which a lot of, you know, mid-30s people still are, that would be all of our money, like literally all of our money. And that, it just blows my mind that it's something that I look at and think, this is not, someday it's going to crack, you know, it's not sustainable for the younger generations. And I hope it doesn't crack badly.
Well, yeah, I mean, pretty much at this point, you have to be doing very well to be able to afford healthcare in the United States, whereas in Canada, you have a higher tax rate here if you make, you know, more money, and that's where your healthcare is coming from. So you might be paying, you know, more, but I don't mind because it's not for profit. You know what I mean? Like I'm paying the government, and it's going to help other Canadian citizens, and it's not helping some rando shareholder get richer, you know, from an insurance company. That's a huge, just like a moral difference to me, that healthcare is not for profit here. And, you know, there aren't people who are getting wealthy making life and death decisions for others. I love that part of it. It helps me sleep at
night. And that's huge, you know, like it's, yeah, we don't, and this can wrap back just to education that we were talking about is these things don't have to be couched in terms of you dirty commies. You know, it can be couched in terms of, you know, compassion and planning for the future and, you know, like really understanding how these systems work and how, you know, trying to help, you know, new people, you know, younger people that are coming up into these systems. And it's, you know, it's tough when the only perspectives you get are the ones that are very fiery and, you know, like, oh, we can't stand those people that want to share everything. You know, it's like, look, I'm not a Soviet communist.
Well, yeah, that is true. Yeah. And this is the value of travel. Honestly, if you get out of your little bubble and start to see that there are different ways of living and doing things, then you're just going to be better off, and you're going to be more compassionate and be more empathetic with people who have views different yeah. than yours. And it just makes you a better human. So I think the freedom of travel would be beneficial for everybody instead of being, I mean, a national rail system would be wonderful in the United States if we had, you know, the high speed rail thing that a lot of other countries have managed to do. It would be wonderful to have that in the U.S.
It really would. I would yeah. do it just for recreation, you know, like just to see yeah. the whole country would be amazing. That's the type of thing that, like, I know that you can. There's some rail systems that work more or less, but a real high speed rail across the middle of the country, I would every year I would take a week on a sleeper cabin and just see the country, and I think that would be so cool.
Yeah, my experiences on trains have been entirely positive. And I only recently, you know, started to do that, and I'm actually hoping. I mean, this is not a for sure thing by any means, but I'm really hoping to be able to put together some sort of train tour of the East and Midwest for March.
Oh yeah,
because and taking a train is cheaper than flying, and you don't have the TSA groping mm-hmm. you every day. So then you get to work comfortably versus a very narrow, you know, cramped space on a tube where you can't open a window. So yeah, I mean, I would rather be on a train at this point. I get to work, I get to be relaxed, and I don't feel suffocated and stuff like that, you know, on the train. So I think I want to put together a train tour for this reissue perhaps of the Iron Druid, and I don't know if I can make it happen or not, but I'd love to be able to do that because I get to see the country. and it's cheaper than flying and less, you know, of a hassle, less of a stress. And so, yeah, well, that'd be wonderful. It won't be high speed,
right?
But it'll be at least it exists and it's doable. So,
oh, that sounds wonderful. Well, I always like to kind of wrap up these episodes by asking each person what the last meal that just blew your mind was. What's the last thing that you ate that you still think about, no matter how long ago it was?
Okay. It was really this place in Minneapolis. It was called The Butcher and the Boar. And it closed down during the pandemic, but it has recently reopened, same location, but with a slightly different name. And I don't know why they had to change the name. But okay. But it's basically the same restaurant. It's now called The Butcher's Tale, T-A-L-E.
Mm-hmm.
And they age their own meat. They cut their own meat and age it there. They have their own charcuterie that they make. And then they have the most amazing drinks, Brian. And then you get a New York that's been aged for 40 days. And these mushrooms that they put on it. And, oh, my God, it's the most amazing meal. And I went there with Delilah. S. Dawson, and for our tour, and that was the last time. And honestly, this train tour that I'm talking about taking in March, it ends in Minneapolis specifically so I can go back to that restaurant. and because somebody tweeted, this is seriously the whole thing. Like, somebody tweeted at me, they knew that I was just obsessed with this restaurant, and they said it's back open again. Look, here's the link, and I check it out, and there's the menu. It's just slightly tweaked here and there, a few new recipes. But I mean, I'm like, oh my God, it's back! I've got to go back to Minneapolis. How can I get back there? Well, hey, maybe I could do something in March. So yeah, it's also that I could go back to this one place. And so if you ever get a chance to go to Minneapolis, Brian, go to the Butcher's Tale. Have one. They had Delilah had a banana old fashioned. You're like, what? It was amazing. And then they have a butter pecan old fashioned that I can't wait to try. It's on the menu now. Incredible steak, incredible drinks. Yeah, best meal. What about you? I'm kind of curious. Like, what was your amazing meal?
Man, you know what? I've spent most of the pandemic cooking for ourselves. We'll occasionally get takeout. So earlier on in this summer, kind of after vaccines became really available, my parents decided that they were going to drive from Ohio, and I decided I hadn't seen my parents for a while. I decided I was going to go all out. I got a full-sized a full-sized beef tenderloin, and it was no joke, like $175 piece of meat. I was really trying to spoil my dad.
Okay.
And so I got this beef tenderloin and I smoked it, and I nailed it. I absolutely nailed it. I don't even remember what the sides were. I put together a really good spread, but that beef tenderloin, I still think about that. What, you know, 5 months later or whatever. It was so dang good.
Yeah, there you go. When you get something amazing like that, yeah, it does stick around. You want to go there again. So,
that was fantasy author Kevin Hearn. Thanks again to Kevin for coming on to chat. You can find links to Kevin's social media and his books down in the show notes. You can find me, as always, at brianmcclellan.com. Special thanks to James Sutter for music and Tom Bishop for production. If you'd like to support the podcast, head on over to patreon.com/pagebreak or buy my books in ebook, paperback, or audio. You can also get signed copies of my books direct from my website. Don't forget to like, subscribe, and leave a review. Huge thanks to Kyle Anderson and Patrick Hunt for their backing on Patreon.
Hey everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight. and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.